This is Midstream and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Informed sources revealed a meeting that brought together multiple Palestinian factions from Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine with the Ansarullah resistance movement in Yemen during the past few days to coordinate regarding the upcoming phase. The sources, as per Agence France-Presse, stated that the purpose of the meeting was to coordinate positions with Ansarullah, who in turn confirmed their continued support operations in the Red Sea and beyond in support of Palestinians facing genocide by Zionist Israel. More details in the following report.
A rare meeting was held last week between leaders of Palestinian resistance factions and the Yemeni Ansarullah resistance group to discuss mechanisms for coordinating the resistance's actions against Zionist Israel, according to Palestinian sources cited by Agence France-Presse, AFP. The agency did not mention the names of these sources it spoke to on Friday evening, but attributed one of them who refused to be named as saying, an important meeting was held last week with senior leaders from Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, along with the Ansarullah resistance movement, to discuss coordination mechanisms between these factions regarding resistance actions in the upcoming stage. According to a second source, also unnamed, the Ansarullah movement confirmed during the meeting that it will continue its operations in the Red Sea against ships heading to the enemy state, meaning Zionist Israel, to support Palestinian resistance. The meeting also discussed the complementarity of the Yemeni role with Palestinian factions, especially with the possibility of Zionist Israel invading Rafah. The agency did not specify the location of the meeting, the names of the participants from the Palestinian faction's leadership, or the Ansarullah movement. This revelation comes after the leader of the Ansarullah resistance movement, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, announced expanding the scope of attacks on ships linked to Zionist Israel, including those avoiding passage through the Red Sea and sailing in the Indian Ocean via the Cape of Good Hope in the far south of the African continent. Since November 19 last year, Yemen's armed forces, which are aligned with Ansarullah, have targeted Israeli entity-linked ships in the Red Sea and the Arab Sea in solidarity with the people of Palestine, who are currently facing genocide in the Gaza Strip. The US and UK have been waging a violent aerial campaign against Yemen since mid-January in response to Yemeni naval operations. Since this campaign began, the scope of Yemen's operations has expanded to include US and British vessels. As a result of Yemeni operations, major international shipping companies have been forced to reroute their vessels around South Africa's Cape of Good Hope, where Ansarullah vowed to prevent ships from reaching as part of the new expanded operations.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Al-Zahri, Yemeni journalist and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Ali. Now, in a very rare meeting, at least since the Al-Aqsa flood operation that happened on October 7, 2023, the Palestinian resistance factions have met secretly with the Yemeni resistance movement Ansarullah. Now, it was not revealed where this meeting took place or with whom and at what level this meeting took place. But what does that meeting signify at this point in time of the genocidal U.S. Zionist war on Gaza?
In the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful, greetings to you and to all the valiant fighters in Palestine, Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and all the free people in this world. Regarding the meeting, it came as a culmination of the coordination and communication efforts since the early days of the Al-Aqsa flood operations, which is a natural outcome dictated by circumstances, data, and the magnitude of the great battle. This meeting is not the first of its kind, as stated by the leader of the revolution, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, that coordination and communication with all resistance movements are ongoing. Each resistance movement has offices in Sana'a, and communication has been ongoing before and after the flood.
But
However, the announcement of this meeting was made without much information about it, as a culmination of this integration in various arenas, and due to the significant developments on the ground, it was necessary to elevate the process of communication and also intensify the strikes to support Palestinian resistance on the negotiation table. There are media reports that the meeting was held in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, which is natural because the battle is won and Yemen must be a supporting front in it. We affirm that the Yemeni Republic coordinates greatly regarding the military aspect in addition to military support. It leaves a negotiation matter, as Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah stated, that the Palestinian negotiator today negotiates on behalf of all resistance movements. We are supportive fronts and leave the negotiation entirely to the Palestinian negotiator. Even the issue of holding the Israeli ship and its crew is solely in the hands of our people in the Al-Qassam Brigades. If they want to keep the crew or exchange them, there is no objection. It's up to them.
Well, Mr. Ali, the leader of the Yemeni Ansarullah movement, Sayyid Abdul Malik Badruddin Houthi, announced in his speech on March 14th that his group will expand its maritime operations in support of the resistance in Gaza against the Israeli entity-linked shipping, not only preventing them from passing through the Arabian Sea or the Red Sea or the Aden, the Gulf of Aden, but also if they pass in the Indian Ocean towards the Cape of Good Hope in the southernmost point of Africa. Was this announcement made after the meeting was held with the Palestinian factions or before it? Because this might, if it happened after it, it might indicate that this was part of something to support the Palestinian resistance in its upcoming negotiations. What do you can say about that?
Our operations since day one have been in support of the Palestinian people and to prevent Zionist ships from passing through the Bab al-Mandeb Strait and reaching the port of Umm al-Rashrash, also known as the port of Eilat. With the continued massacres and genocide against our people in Palestine and the imposition of the siege on them, all ships heading to the ports of occupied Palestine were prevented from reaching, even those with different nationalities, thus tightening the noose on the occupation. When the Americans and the British intervened and announced their alliance called Prosperity Guardian and attacked the Yemeni Navy, resulting in 10 martyrs, their ships were subsequently included in the target list. With the tightening of the blockade in Gaza and talks of famine and deaths among the elderly and children, where more than 15 children died from famine, malnutrition and drought, it became imperative for us to further tighten the noose on the occupation.
موضوع العدوان علينا والرد على الأمريكيين نحن نستهدف السفن وبوارجه الحربية وسفن.
Thus, the announcement was made to expand Yemeni operations from the Red Sea to the Bab al-Mandeb Strait, to the Gulf of Aden, to the Arabian Sea, and now towards the Indian Ocean. These operations are exclusively linked to Palestine and supporting our people in Palestine. Regarding the aggression against Yemen and our response to the American British, we target their warships and merchant vessels. However, the expansion to the Indian Ocean is related to the Zionist siege on Gaza. As mentioned by Mr. Commander Abdul Malik al-Houthi, since the beginning of the war on Gaza, a group of missiles and drones has been launched from Sana'a, more than what was launched in 8 years on Saudi Arabia during the aggression on Yemen, and the coming is greater. The more severe the blockade and aggression against our people in Gaza, the greater our response will be.
This is what I want to discuss, Mr. Ali, because what do you think are the prospects of increasing this kind of economic pressure on the Zionist Israeli entity and the Americans and the UK by default? Will it escalate tensions in the region? I mean, could it potentially expand the scope of the conflict if the aggression on Gaza did not stop, if the negotiations did not work?
Whenever the blockade and aggression on Gaza intensify, it becomes imperative for the resistance in Gaza to escalate its strikes. and it becomes necessary for supporting fronts in various arenas to expand their operations. What we witnessed recently in terms of expansion in the north along the Lebanese border, there was an intensification of strikes by the Islamic resistance in Hezbollah, as well as in Yemen and Iraq. Thus, the expansion of the conflict is contingent on Zionist performance. The tighter the siege on our people in Gaza and the more frequent their strikes, the more there will be intensification of Palestinian strikes and strikes by supporting movements, because we must confront escalation with escalation.
نواجه تصعيد بالتصعيد. إذا الكرة اليوم في ملعب الأمريكي والصهيوني. إذا ما أراد عدم توسيع الصراع فعليه أن يوقف عدوانه وأن يرفع الحصار.
The ball is now in the court of the American and Zionist aggressors. If they do not want to escalate the conflict further, they must cease their aggression and lift the siege on Gaza. If they persist in aggression, the region will inevitably witness further escalation. All our options are open, as Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said. Between us lies the battlefield, the days and the nights. If the Israeli entity opts for escalation, they will not be received with flowers, smiles, statements or condemnations, but rather with more strikes, more iron and fire. Supporting operations are effective, and it is up to the Zionists and their settlers to endure these strikes, this siege and this situation that is heading towards a greater escalation.
هذا الحصار وهذه الضربات وهذا الوضع الذي هو يعني يعني متجه الى نحو التصعيد اكثر.
Mr. Ali Al-Zahri, Yemeni journalist and political commentator, it's a pleasure to have you on with us to discuss the meeting that happened between the Palestinian resistance factions and the Ansarullah Yemeni resistance faction. And from my platform, again, I want to thank my brothers and sisters in Yemen for their support for our brothers and sisters in Palestine. We are definitely one nation, one people, and this past war, genocidal war on Gaza, has proven that we are. So, ladies and gents, thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
in the limelight.
The deliberate targeting of Gaza health infrastructure, manufactured scarcity of medical supplies and fuel, and restricted access to basic necessities are all different means through which the destruction of healthcare has been used as a weapon of war by the child killer regime of Israel. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned, please. Crescent International wrote, "The Zionist regime army has been relentless in its targeting of healthcare workers and infrastructure in Gaza. This is not a new strategy employed by the Zionist regime. Health has, for years, been previously documented as being used as a weapon against the occupied Palestinian population. While this is not a novel concept in modern-day warfare, we have not seen the tactic used on such a large scale to strangulate a population before. The deliberate targeting of health infrastructure, manufactured scarcity of medical supplies and fuel, and restricted access to basic necessities are all different means through which the destruction of healthcare has been used as a weapon of war. With these actions, the Zionist regime seeks to amplify the scale of human losses inflicted on civilians in the Gaza Strip and push the survivors into exodus." Prior to October 7, 2023, healthcare system in Gaza were already teetering on the brink, with only 36 hospitals operating as full capacity and a total of 3,412 beds catering to a population exceeding 2 million people. This data indicates a maximum ratio of 1.55 hospitals beds per 1,000 individuals across the entire region. Patients requiring access to specialized treatment outside of Gaza have routinely been prevented from exiting. In 2021 alone, over 36% of requests for medical permits were either refused or left unanswered by Israeli occupation authorities, condemning patients with urgent conditions to preventable death. In January this year, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs released the statistics related to the medical situation being faced in Gaza due to the unrelenting Israeli aggression. 337 healthcare workers have been martyred. 145 UN staff have been killed. 14 of 36 hospitals in Gaza are only partially functional, and they suffer from outages and major shortages of medical supplies. 26 of 36 hospitals in Gaza are damaged. 122 ambulances have been damaged. 1.9 million Gaza residents are displaced. The numbers are shocking, and the extent of damage is unfathomable, difficult to comprehend through numbers alone. By November 2023, all hospitals in northern Gaza were completely out of service. It was at this point that we witnessed the Zionist regime leading armed invasions of hospitals, including the largest medical complex in the region, Ash-Shifa, and the Indonesian hospital, which at the time was the last remaining operational hospital in northern Gaza. This demonstrates a sustained and orchestrated Israeli policy to destroy healthcare facilities, forcing their evacuation. Despite claims by the Zionist regime army that armed Palestinian groups have used health facilities for military purposes, according to Human Rights Watch, no evidence has yet been presented that provides legal justification for the loss of the protected status of hospitals and other health infrastructure as codified by international humanitarian law. An extensive Washington Post investigation of the Zionist regime's attacks and invasion of Ashrafal Hospital found that the evidence provided by Israel does not demonstrate that the hospital was being used as a command and control center, nor that the hospital building is connected to a larger tunnel network. Notably, the burden of proof remains with the accuser to provide adequate evidence that the protected status of a health facility has been lost. In case of doubt, there should be a presumption of civilian status. If a health facility lost its protected status, the principles of proportionality, precaution, and distinction still apply. Despite these clear international laws, the destruction of the healthcare system has been the main thrust of the Zionist occupation army's clear strategy. Repeated patterns of these attacks indicate that damages inflicted on Gaza's already precarious health system and the systematic murder of medical staff are part of a broader strategy seeking to weaponize healthcare. Despite these clear international laws, the destruction of the healthcare system has been the main thrust of the Zionist occupation army's clear strategy. Beyond overt destruction, UNICEF released its report number 20, documenting the broader health-related impacts being suffered by the civilian Gaza population. They include high levels of displacement and overcrowding in collective centers and scattered sites in the Gaza Strip continue with extremely challenging hygiene and sanitation conditions. On average, 340 individuals share one toilet and 1,290 persons share one shower. The babies of 5,500 women who are due to give birth in the next month in the Gaza Strip are at risk of dying, as their mothers do not have access to prenatal or postnatal checkups because of bombings and need to flee for safety. Anxiety is also leading to premature births, as reported by the United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA. Over 90% of children aged 6 to 23 months and pregnant, breastfeeding women face severe food poverty, with access to two or fewer food groups per day. In addition, withdrawal of fuel and power sources and the closure of all humanitarian corridors for the delivery of aid has created dire conditions for the outbreak of multiple epidemics. Cases of scabies, lice, chickenpox, skin rash, hepatitis A, and upper respiratory infections have been reportedly rising in a context of disrupted vaccination campaigns and disease surveillance systems. The weaponization of healthcare negates the right to exist and resist. It is a means of collectively punishing a population and discouraging or deterring any form of resistance, whether peaceful or violent. Attacking so disproportionately against a civilian population not only contradicts the basic tenets of international humanitarian law, it also perpetuates structural power imbalances born out of the asymmetry seen between the colonizer and the colonized. By instilling fear, physical and psychological trauma, the weaponization of health is instrumental to forcibly displace Palestinians by means of rendering Gaza uninhabitable and hostile. Any credible commitment to and movement for health justice must see both the ongoing and long-standing violence against healthcare workers and attacks against healthcare in this context as an extension of the systematic campaign of violence and oppression against the Palestinian people.
8-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
On March 1st, Iran held elections for its parliament. More than 25 million people went to the polls to choose the next members of the legislative branch, which has a direct influence on the country's foreign policy. The rise of some new figures has already changed dramatically the configuration of the next parliament. They've challenged the authority of established figures such as Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf, the Speaker of the Parliament, who has a long political career, including running for president and serving as Tehran's mayor. But can they change the course of the country in the international arena? Or will they keep the status quo? Sanctions, the Iran nuclear deal, and the Afghans living in Iran are but a few issues related to Iran's foreign policy that the upcoming parliament has to deal with as matters of great urgency. The 2024 parliamentary elections have had some surprises for the country and the world that might affect the parliament's general approach towards issues of international significance. The three of top vote-getters in the capital city of Tehran, comprised of clerics Mahmoud Nabavian and Hamid Rassai, who clinched first and third places respectively, and Amir Hossein Sabati, a young conservative activist and news show host who came in second place. Most notably, the election brought a stunning reversal of fortune for the current parliamentary speaker Ghalibaf. Once the top vote-getter with 1,265,287 votes in the 2020 parliamentary elections, he experienced a quick fall to fourth place this time around, securing only 447,905 votes. The three top vote-getters in Tehran are all members of the Front of Islamic Revolution Stability. Its politicians have track records of opposing both moderate conservatives and reformists and were the loudest critics of the Rouhani administration. The top vote-getter in Tehran, Nabavian, is a former parliamentarian known for his rigid stance on foreign policy, especially his fierce opposition to the nuclear negotiations that resulted in the 2015 nuclear deal, known also as the JCPOA. This is Dr. Kamran Ghazanfari, a senior expert on international relations, who has been elected as a representative of Tehran for the next parliament. It is said that the new parliament doesn't deeply believe in the JCPOA as an agreement that could solve the country's problem. In other words, it could be an anti-JCPOA parliament, so to speak. What do you think?
As for the JCPOA, the agreement died a few years ago and nothing is left of it except for its name. As you may remember, the leader of the Islamic Revolution referred to the JCPOA in March 2015 in the holy city of Mashhad as a complete loss. What President Rouhani and Foreign Minister Zarif called an international achievement actually caused great damage to the country. As the leader put it, it was a complete loss. Naturally, the 11th parliament was not a fan of the JCPOA, and the next parliament should pay no attention to it. The deal was a non-starter from the very beginning.
The results of the March elections will certainly have its impacts on the direction of Iran's political landscape, with implications for both domestic policies and international relations. Mr. Abolfaz Zohrevand is a seasoned diplomat who has been working for the Iranian Ministry of Foreign Affairs for almost four decades. He is a former ambassador of Iran to Rome and Kabul, who has been elected as a representative of Tehran in the next parliament.
Basically, what are the building blocks of Iran's foreign policy?
Pinpointing threats and opportunities constitutes a key part of any country's foreign policy. We should be able to determine our opportunities and turn them into tangible achievements. For example, selling oil, capturing a market, or establishing a cultural relationship with a certain country. This could be the main mission of foreign policy.
Iran's parliament has a long history dating back to the early 20th century when the country underwent a period of constitutional revolution. Since then, especially after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, the Iranian parliament has played a significant role in shaping the country's foreign policy priorities. Following the revolution, Iran's foreign policy underwent a radical shift with a focus on anti-Western sentiments and support for freedom-seeking movements across the region. In this regard, the Iranian parliament has played a key role in supporting these policies and shaping Iran's foreign relations. This is Ruhollah Izzatkhah, a representative of Tehran in the 11th parliament, who has been re-elected for the next parliament.
About the resistance movement, the previous parliaments were not as active as they were supposed to be, maybe because they thought that the government was active enough in this regard. But I think the parliament should get involved, especially in the Palestinian cause. It has to take a strong stance on it and shape effective relations in favor of the resistance movement, along with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the National Security Council, and other related organs.
The country's support for resistance groups such as Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in Palestine has had positive effects, such as promoting solidarity among countries in the region that share similar anti-Western, anti-hegemonic sentiments. The U.S. in this sense has always been a problem in Iran's foreign policy. Tehran insists that Washington should stop its hegemonic ambitions in West Asia and considers it as the root cause of regional instability. But will the new parliament take direct action so as to confront the U.S.? Or is there any tendency among the top vote-getters to bury the hatchet?
Now, the relations with the United States is still considered as a main challenge in Iran's foreign policy. How do you think the new parliament plans to tackle this issue?
آمریکا از همون ابتدای پیروزی انقلاب اسلامی بنا رو بر خصومت با ما گذاشت.
Just after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, the United States took an antagonistic attitude towards our nation. They began arming opposition groups inside the country, supporting terrorist groups and separatists inside and outside the country. And they tried to sow division among people with the aim of pushing the country towards civil war. All these subversive measures were followed by their help to Saddam Hussein to wage a bloody war against Iran, which took 8 years. After the imposed war, none of the following administrations from the Bush administration up to now took an amicable approach towards the Islamic Republic. On the contrary, each one hatched a plot to topple the Islamic Republic. They imposed all kinds of pressures on the country to topple the established system in Iran. How do you expect us to talk and negotiate with them without wasting our breath?
There's plenty more to be said, but first a quick media review to give other outlets a chance to get a word in.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of the program. Here, we'll go over some news headlines. March the 1st polls fueled by patriotism and political awareness. Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf underscored the robust turnout in both parliamentary and assembly of experts elections, expressing gratitude towards the Iranian populace and election officials for their contributions to the democratic process. He specifically lauded the efforts of security and police forces for their astute management in ensuring the election's security. In his address, Speaker Ghalibaf emphasized the accountability of parliament representatives to all constituents, urging them to prioritize public interests over partisan agendas. Iran leader says new parliament brings fresh hopes for country. The leader made the remarks in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts in Tehran on Sunday.
Ayatollah Khamenei said a new parliament is like fresh blood in Iran's political and social structure. The leader urged the newly elected Iranian lawmakers to be cautious not to embitter the nation and the political atmosphere of the country. Ayatollah Khamenei emphasized that divisive wars, quarrels, and hostilities, which are favorable to the enemy, can kill the sweetness of the new parliament, advising the new lawmakers to be very careful. The leader stressed that Iran should always stand at the forefront of the battle against global arrogance and added that the country should strengthen its fight every day and never allow anyone to defeat it. Iran says willing to improve ties with neighboring countries. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, said Tehran is willing to improve relations with neighboring countries. In a speech during the Third Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022, Amir Abdollahian said Tehran welcomes rebuilding trust and constructive cooperation with its neighbors, especially the Persian Gulf countries. And that brings us to the end of this section. Let's go back to the main narrative.
Iran's parliament, also known as the Islamic Consultative Assembly, has the power to influence and oversee the government's diplomatic decisions and engagements with other nations. What do you think the next parliament's priority is going to be in terms of the country's foreign policy?
The country needs to revise its economic policies and take initiatives instead of being on the sidelines. This can be done under the rubric of economic diplomacy. The government needs to have a detailed guideline in this regard and stop acting on an ad hoc basis. The parliament should enter this area by passing comprehensive laws for the country's economic diplomacy. At the same time, we should tap into the potential of our neighboring states and simultaneously establish systematic economic ties with other countries. For example, we can establish even stronger ties with Russia as it seeks our advice on circumventing sanctions, especially after the outbreak of the war with Ukraine.
One of the key functions of the Iranian parliament in shaping the country's foreign policy is through the ratification of treaties and international agreements. As outlined in the Iranian constitution, all international agreements must be approved by the parliament before they can be implemented. This process ensures that the interests and concerns of the Iranian people are taken into consideration before committing to any international commitments.
Concerning foreign policy, everything begins from the country's interaction with its neighbors. Since Mr. Raisi came to office, we've had two key achievements. First, we officially joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and second, we officially joined BRICS. That said, these memberships are just the first steps, and we need to turn them into opportunities. So far, we haven't been very successful in this regard, and I think the next parliament should take proper action. If the administration needs any special support, the parliament should provide it as soon as possible so we can reap the benefits of such memberships.
Additionally, the parliament has the authority to reject or amend any international agreement that is not in the best interest of the country.
What was the fruit of the nuclear talks? That's our question. What was the biggest achievement of the nuclear talks? What has been the result of direct or indirect talks with the Americans? Have the Americans abandoned their hostile policies against the Islamic Republic? Have they abandoned their hegemonic policies in the region? If you look at what is unfolding in Gaza, you'll find out the answer. The fact is, the Americans have not and will not abandon their hegemonic policies. Over the past few months, they have lent their unconditional support to the Israeli regime. The majority of bombs and ammunition the regime is using against the innocent people in Gaza are provided by the US. Despite what they say, they have no respect for human rights at all. So I think we have to take a more revolutionary stance against both the US government and its puppet regimes and treat them from a stronger position.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. This series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Furthermore, the Iranian parliament plays a crucial role in overseeing the government's foreign policy decisions and actions. Through its various committees, such as the National Security and Foreign Policy Committee, the parliament conducts regular evaluations of the government's foreign relations and policies. This oversight mechanism ensures transparency and accountability in the conduct of Iran's diplomacy. We also talked to Mr. Vali Dadashi, a member of the 10th Parliament Islamic from the electorate of Astara, Gilan, in the north of Iran. Mr. Dadashi has also been elected for the next parliament.
According to the Iranian constitution, the parliament has a supervisory role in addition to representing the electorate and making laws. In this sense, the parliament should make sure that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is pursuing the country's official foreign policy. We have to ensure that the ministry is fulfilling its mission of developing relations with other countries across the world. The parliament can and should help the ministry facilitate international agreements and accords, on condition that they would be to the benefit of the Iranian nation.
Moreover, the Iranian parliament has the power to initiate and pass legislation that directly impacts the country's foreign policy. For example, the parliament can introduce and enact laws related to economic sanctions, trade agreements, and diplomatic relations with other countries. By drafting and passing legislation, the parliament can influence the direction and priority of Iran's foreign policy.
As for our relations with the U.S., we had a bitter experience in recent years. I'm talking about the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA. It was a bitter lesson for us and an eye-opening experience for the rest of the world that the Americans do not honor their promises and that they are not even honest with their closest allies. I think post-JCPOA, Iran will have fundamental changes in its relations with the U.S. In this parliament, we ratified the Strategic Action Plan to lift sanctions and protect Iranian nations' interests. The Rouhani administration tried to prevent the law from being passed, but the parliament passed it anyway, and according to the leader of the revolution, saved the country from limbo.
In addition to its legislative functions, the Iranian parliament also plays a role in promoting dialogue and diplomacy with other countries. Through its parliamentary diplomacy initiatives, the Iranian parliament engages in exchanges with foreign legislators and officials to promote mutual understanding and cooperation. These interactions can help build bridges between Iran and other nations, foster peace and stability in the region, and advance Iran's foreign policy objectives.
How can the upcoming parliament help the government in its foreign policy agenda?
Parliament has a significant capacity of its own. There is an important committee called the National Security and Foreign Policy Committee, which is composed of political elites. At the same time, there are over 20 interparliamentary friendship groups in the parliament. This capacity can help any administration in their interacting with other countries. As a national organ that represents the whole nation, the parliament can have independent relations with other countries' parliament. This way, the parliament can bridge the gap with the target country, preparing the ground for diplomats to deepen the country's relations with the rest of the world.
Iran's nuclear program, a key aspect of its foreign policy agenda, has been a source of contention, leading to sanctions and diplomatic tensions with the Western bloc. The JCPOA, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, is a landmark agreement over Iran's peaceful nuclear program. Signed in 2015 by Iran, the United States, United Kingdom, France, China, Russia, and Germany, the JCPOA was seen as a significant diplomatic achievement. However, the agreement has faced challenges, particularly with the United States under President Donald Trump withdrawing from the deal in 2018. The withdrawal of the U.S. from the agreement has strained relations between Iran and the other signatories, leaving the nuclear deal in a moribund state. Will the rise of figures such as Nabavian, who were critical of the deal from the very beginning, be the final nail in the agreement's coffin? Should we brace ourselves for any radical changes with respect to the new parliament's foreign policy approach?
Given the initial results, it has become clear that almost half of the current representatives have failed to win a seat in the next parliament. It means that people expect serious changes. Although the leader of the Islamic Revolution called the 11th parliament the revolutionary parliament, in comparison to the 10th parliament, which was in line with the Rouhani administration's pro-Western policies, it seems that the 11th parliament has not fulfilled people's expectations, and it seems that they expect an even more revolutionary parliament for the future.
Mr. Zohrevan, on the other hand, believes that Iran has to balance out its relations with both the East and the West.
A key component of Iran's foreign policy in the recent years has been pivot to the East. To what extent do you think that the next parliament is willing to better relations with the West in an attempt to create a diplomatic balance?
When we are talking about the West, we should look at it as a whole. We should enumerate both its positive and its negative aspects. We should not put all our eggs in one basket. It's not to the benefit of our country. Take China, for example. Although the country is not always on good terms with the United States of America, it is the main exporter of goods to the U.S. We should take a realistic approach in our foreign policy. We don't need to be perfectly good with a country before benefiting from ties with that country. We should balance our relations with both the West and the East for the benefit of our country.
Afghan refugees in Iran have been a pressing issue for Tehran, an issue with significant social, economic, and political implications. Will the upcoming parliament have any plans for it?
The influx of Afghan refugees into Iran dates back to the Soviet-Afghan War in the 1980s, when millions of Afghans sought refuge in neighboring countries, including Iran. The situation was further exacerbated by the rise of the Taliban in the 1990s and the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. Despite international efforts to address the issue, the presence of Afghans in Iran remains a complex and challenging problem, with far-reaching consequences for both countries.
Another serious concern for the Iranian nation is the amount of Afghan refugee population, which is estimated to be around 7 to 8 million people. What do you think the next parliament plans to deal with this issue?
First of all, we need to have a transparent policy on migration. We should know exactly what we have to do with Afghans who live in Iran. Needless to say, they should live in Iran legally. They should have legal permission for it. We should have detailed information about them, their jobs, their homes, their incomes, etc., etc. And we have to make sure that they are obeying the country's rules and regulations.
The sheer number of Afghans living in Iran, estimated as high as 7 to 8 million, has strained Iran's resources and infrastructure, leading sometimes, if not always, to social tension, competition for jobs, and overcrowded urban areas. The presence of Afghan refugees has also had security implications. From a political perspective, the issue of Afghans in Iran has become a contentious topic, with debates over citizenship rights, deportation policies, and international obligations.
The government has taken measures in this regard. Tehran has repeatedly asked the Afghan authorities to move toward democracy. I think with a democratic political system in Afghanistan, Afghans living in Iran will go back to their own country. If they feel social security in their homeland, they will return to Afghanistan. Tehran has discussed this issue with the Afghan government. This is, I think, the root solution to the problem.
Overall, the Iranian parliament is a crucial institution in shaping and overseeing the country's foreign policy.
Through its legislative functions, oversight mechanism, and diplomatic engagement, the parliament ensures that Iran's foreign policy is in line with the interests and aspirations of the Iranian people. By working collaboratively with the government, the parliament can contribute to a more effective and principled foreign policy that promotes Iran's national interests and contributes to global peace and stability. That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Please do join us again same times to see what else is on. Till next time, take care.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The systematic targeting of distribution centers has become a new tactic routinely employed by the Zionist regime army, along with the so-called flower massacres, in order to further implement a policy of starvation against the population of the besieged Gaza Strip. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "The systematic targeting of distribution centers has become a new tactic routinely employed by the Zionist regime army along with the so-called flower massacres in order to further implement a policy of starvation against the population of the besieged Gaza Strip. Recently, Israeli regime forces bombed a building managed by the United Nations Relief Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, serving as a distribution center. The attack killed at least 5 people and injured many more. On that same day, the Zionist regime military targeted another distribution center belonging to the Palestinian Ministry of Social Development, located in the Nusayrah refugee camp in the central Gaza Strip. The Palestine Chronicle has spoken with relatives of 4 victims of the Zionist regime's bombing. Mu'at Al-Hur told the Palestine Chronicle, "My 15-year-old brother Mohammad went to collect a packet of diapers for my young cousin at the distribution center in Nusayrat. While he was waiting for his turn to get the diapers, the occupation bombed the distribution center and my brother Mohammad was instantly killed." Like many people in the Gaza Strip, Mohammed's family had been displaced more than once during the ongoing Zionist regime's aggression. We were displaced from our home in Nusayrat 3 months ago, and we lived in a tent in Rafah City in the south for about a month. But when the Israeli forces withdrew from the camp, we realized that the bombing was everywhere, and we decided to return home, Al-Hur said. He added, our house was hit by a shell from the occupation artillery one day, and by God's grace, we managed to survive. He said, but my younger brother, Muhammad, felt that he would be martyred. He felt he was pursued by the occupation's missiles. And indeed, he was killed at a distribution center, Al-Hur said with a broken voice. The Zionist regime bombing has not spared social workers and volunteers who are relentlessly trying to help the civilian population amid the catastrophic humanitarian situation in Gaza. Mohammed Al-Dashat told the Palestine Chronicle, I'm a social worker at the Ministry of Social Development, which is dedicated to caring for the poor in the Gaza Strip. Al-Dashat's brother, 42-year-old Osama, used to work at the vocational training center in Khan Yunis, affiliated with the ministry. At the beginning of the war, however, he was assigned to the distribution center in the Nusayrat camp. His younger brother, Raed, 29 years old, decided to go with him to volunteer at the center, along with their 21-year-old nephew, Amir. Al-Dashat told the Palestine Chronicle, every day we saw thousands of displaced people searching for food for their children, and we distributed the supplies we received, which were very limited anyway. Al-Dashat continued, on Thursday morning, I went to the headquarters of the ministry in Deir al-Balah city to attend an emergency meeting regarding aid distribution. I was still there when we received news of the bombing in Nusayrat. I left the meeting and went there immediately. The distance between Deir al-Balah and Nusayrat is about 5 kilometers. Along the way, I could not stop thinking of my brothers and nephew, and I was overwhelmed by fear. He said, as I arrived at the scene, I found traces of the bombing, with blood scattered everywhere. The aid packages that were supposed to be distributed were mixed with the blood of the martyrs. Al-Dashat told Palestine Chronicle that after the bombing, there is no place to receive aid in Nusayrat. He called for an investigation into this heinous crime by the Zionist regime.
Hello and welcome to our program. I'm your host, Ali Reza Ikhtiarzadeh. Today, we go face to face with the head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, Mr. Mohammad Islami, as we talk about the different fields where Iran has made significant advancements in when it comes to nuclear science and technology, and also talk about some of the double standards that the UN nuclear watchdog has been using when it comes to its attitude towards the Islamic Republic of Iran and see where it originates from. So stay tuned. Mr. Mohammed Islami, thank you for joining the program.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you.
We are as well. So let's first talk about the document.